Imagine you're holding like $1 million in futures contracts. It's a completely calm Tuesday morning.
Oh, famous last words right there.
Right. Because suddenly, this massive, unexpected news report drops.
Yeah.
The market just craters like 10% in 3 seconds.
Complete free fall, panic mode.
Exactly. So you hit the panic button to sell everything and just get out, but your computer just sits there. Your order never executes.
Oh, man, the absolute worst nightmare.
Yeah, you're trapped in a free fall, losing thousands of dollars a second, all because you accidentally chose a stop limit order instead of a plain stop order.
It happens way more often than you'd think, too.
It's terrifying. But before we jump into the exact mechanics of how to survive that specific scenario, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check them out at certfuel.com.
Honestly, it's an incredible resource for getting into the precise headspace you need for this specific exam, especially with, the nuances of market mechanics.
Yeah. And the nuances are exactly what we're going to dismantle today. So welcome in, everyone.
Yeah.
Today, you and our resident market expert are going on a very targeted mission. We are conquering basic order types for the Series 3 exam.
And we really need to establish the stakes right out of the gate here. Because when we talk about order types, we are not just discussing like a minor footnote or a piece of trivia.
This isn't just vocabulary.
Exactly. Part one of your Series 3 exam spans roughly 71% of the entire test, covering chapters 1 through 7 combined. Now, the NFA doesn't publish the exact per unit weights, but make no mistake, order types are the absolute backbone of this entire assessment.
71%. I mean, that is basically the whole ball game.
It really is. If you don't intimately understand how these orders function, you cannot possibly understand risk management or hedging strategies or margin. Without this foundation, you simply cannot pass the exam.
Well, that makes the mission pretty clear. But just staring at a textbook definition isn't going to build that foundation. I mean, I have ADHD, so reading dry technical terms just instantly puts my brain to sleep.
Yeah, looking at a list of order types is basically like reading the terms and conditions on a software update.
Exactly. It's dry, it's technical, and your instinct is to just memorize the bold words and hope for the best. But memorization will absolutely betray you under pressure. We need a reliable framework.
And I have a framework that's going to guide us through this entire discussion. For the duration of this deep dive, I want you to anchor yourself to one golden rule. The Series 3 exam is relentlessly testing you on two distinct mechanical facts for every single order type.
Okay, I'm taking notes. What are the two facts?
First, where does the order sit relative to the current market price? Like, is it placed above the market or is it placed below the market?
Okay, where it's got it.
Yeah.
And the second?
Second, what does that order biologically become the exact millisecond it gets triggered? Does it turn into a market order? Or does it mutate into a limit order? That is the entire secret to this unit, where it sits and what it becomes.
Where it sits and what it becomes. If you can identify those two properties, the exam questions just turn into basic logical reasoning, right? Not panic-inducing memorization traps.
Exactly. It completely diffuses the trap.
I love that.
Yeah.
But understanding the mechanics is only half the battle. We also need to understand the psychology behind why a trader chooses one order over another. To do that, we're going to rely on a cast of recurring fictional characters. I want you, the listener, to picture these people in your head right now because their personalities perfectly mirror the specific order types they use.
This is great. Tying it to real human emotion makes it stick so much better.
Right. Okay, so first up we have Frantic Frank. Frank is perpetually panicking. He's always sweating through his dress shirt.
We all know a frantic Frank.
Oh, absolutely. Frank just wants to get in or out of the market immediately. He completely ignores what it might cost him. He's the guy just mashing the keyboard when the market gets volatile.
He represents the sheer need for immediate execution.
Exactly. Then, on the completely opposite end of the spectrum, we have stubborn Steve. Steve is an absolute control freak. His tie is always perfectly straight. His desk is immaculate.
He's probably got like a perfectly color-coded spreadsheet open at all
Oh,
times.
100%. Steve absolutely refuses to take a bad price, even if his stubbornness means he misses the trade entirely. He would literally rather watch the ship go down than pay a single penny more than his target.
Control at all costs.
Yep. And finally, we have bargain hunting Brenda. Brenda is the ultimate strategist. She's always clipping coupons, always looking for a deal. She
Right.
buys the dips, she sells the rallies, and she absolutely refuses to pay retail price for a futures contract.
I really like this approach. Frantic Frank, stubborn Steve, and bargain hunting Brenda. it maps perfectly to the reality of the marketplace. An order type is never just code. It's an expression of a human trader's emotional state and risk tolerance.
So let's start by dissecting Frantic Frank's favorite tool. This is the foundation of everything else we'll talk about, the market order. I like to think of this as the get me in now guarantee. Frank doesn't care about the nuances, he just wants the position.
Right, a market order is undeniably the most primal, basic instruction a trader can possibly transmit to an exchange. When you submit a market order, you're telling the matching engine, fill my order immediately at the very best price currently available on the board.
No price conditions, no boundaries.
Absolutely none.
Yeah.
Because it represents an unconditional willingness to transact, it leaps to the absolute front of the line. The core concept here, and this is the bedrock of market microstructure, is that a market order guarantees a fill, but it absolutely does not guarantee a price.
Okay, let's ground this in a physical reality. Frank is staring at his trading platform. The market is plunging. He wants to buy a futures contract right now. He hits the button. To me, this feels exactly like walking up to a super busy ticket counter at a sold-out stadium, slapping a signed blank check on the glass and shouting, "Give me one ticket, whatever the going rate is."
That analogy captures the fundamental trade-off perfectly. You're guaranteed to walk away holding a ticket, but the seller gets to write whatever number they want on your blank check. You demand liquidity, so you have to pay whatever the market demands to give it to you.
But let's look at what Frank is actually seeing on his screen. I want to ask you, the listener, a direct question here. So think about it. If Frank is looking at his monitor and the big glowing number says the last traded price was $50 and he clicks buy at market, does he definitely get it for $50?
I'll give them a beat to think about it.
Okay, time's up. The answer is
absolutely not, and it's the most common misconception among new traders. The number you see on your screen, that $50, is a historical artifact. It's the past. But your market order is executing in the present. This introduces the most critical friction point in trading, slippage.
Slippage. Let's unpack that. Frank hits the button. What is physically happening between his computer and the market that causes the price to change?
Well, when Frank hits buy, his command travels through his broker over the fiber optic networks and arrives at the exchange's matching engine. Now, in a normal, calm market with immense volume, a thick market, there are hundreds of limit orders resting right at $50.
So he gets filled at 50 easily.
Usually, yes. Mm-hmm. But what happens if the market is thin? Like, it's a holiday week, volume is incredibly low, and there just aren't a lot of participants providing liquidity.
Or worse, what if it's a fast market? The exact moment the Federal Reserve drops a surprise rate announcement.
Exactly. In a fast market, total chaos erupts. The algorithms and the market makers instantly pull their orders to protect themselves from the volatility. When they pull their orders, the bid-ask spread violently widens out.
The bid-ask spread, just a quick reminder, being the gap between what buyers want to pay and what sellers demand to receive.
Precisely. So Frank's market order arrives, screaming, "Buy at any price." But the market makers have vanished, so the nearest seller who is actually willing to part with their contract has moved their asking price way up to $52 or maybe even $55.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Frank's market order has no conditions. It doesn't hesitate. It just reaches right up the order book and grabs that $55 price. A buyer gets filled higher than they expected, and a seller gets filled lower. That is slippage.
The trade-off for certainty of execution is the total uncertainty of cost. And this is exactly where the exam tries to get you. If an answer choice says a market order locks in a specific price or guarantees an entry point, what should the listener do?
Immediately eliminate it. It is completely fundamentally wrong. Market orders guarantee fills, never prices. Every other complex trap in this unit builds on that one fact.
Okay, I hear that, but let me challenge the extreme end of this blank check concept. Frank is frantic, sure, but the exchange has to have some level of risk management, right? What if it's a literal flash crash, algorithms go haywire, and there's only one greedy seller left on the network asking for $1 million? Is Frank going to pay $1 million and bankrupt his bloodline?
It's a real fear. And historically, that kind of anomaly did happen. But today, exchanges recognize the systemic risk of an unbound market order. That's why electronic platforms like the CME Globex system enforce a feature known as market with protection.
Market with protection. How does that physically alter Frank's blank check?
It acts as an automatic guardrail. You don't even have to select a special box. The exchange's matching engine just automatically applies a predefined range of protection points based on the best available price when your order arrives.
So it's basically saying, we'll fill you immediately, but we draw a line in the sand.
Exactly. It prevents fills at wildly absurd prices during a sudden market dislocation.
That makes sense as a safety net. But what mechanically happens to the rest of the order? Say Frank is trying to buy a block of 500 contracts. He chews through the sellers at 50, 51, 52, and then hits that extreme guardrail boundary at 55. But he's only bought 200 contracts. He still has 300 left to buy. Do they just vanish?
This is highly testable right here. The unfilled portion, those remaining 300 contracts, does not get canceled, and it doesn't keep chasing the price to infinity. It hard stops at that exact $55 boundary line, and it rests on the exchange's order book as a limit order at that exact protection price.
Wait, hold on. Let me stop you there. If the unfilled remainder rests as a limit order, does that mean the exam considers market with protection to be a limit order?
Absolutely not, and I am so glad you brought that up because it is a massive trap. I need to be so clear on this. Even with the protection points applied, and even if a portion eventually rests in the book, its initial biological state is still fundamentally a market order.
So it guarantees a fill for whatever is available, but still doesn't guarantee the price for those shares.
Right. When you face this on the exam, you have to treat it as a market order that happens to wear a helmet, not as a limit order.
I love that. A market order wearing a helmet. Okay, we've talked a lot about orders arriving at the exchange and matching with sellers, but let's build the arena. Where is this actually happening? Because when I think of futures trading, I picture 1980s movies. Guys in bright jackets in a pit, screaming, throwing hand signals, paper tickets everywhere.
It's such a romantic image. And for a century, that open outcry pit was the heartbeat of global finance. But today, that world is functionally extinct. Futures trade almost exclusively on massive electronic platforms via a central limit order book, or the CLO.
The CLO sounds like a sci-fi weapon. So those screaming floor brokers are just server racks and data centers now.
Exactly. Acres of humming, climate-controlled servers. You can visualize the CLO by looking at a depth of market screen. You see a central column of prices, a stack of buy limit orders on the left, and sell limit orders on the right.
But if there are thousands of traders hitting buttons at the same time, what are the rigid rules of the arena? How does the CLO decide who gets to trade first?
The CLO operates on a strictly ruthless algorithm based on price time priority. The golden rule is that the best price always fills first. Period. No negotiation. If you offer the most aggressive price, you skip the entire line.
Because you're improving the market. But what if there's a tie? Say 10 traders all want to buy $50.
Then it's a race. Earliest time fills first. Price is the primary sorter. Time is the secondary tiebreaker, down to the nanosecond.
Okay, let's test this with a scenario, because the real world feels like it plays by different rules. Listener, I want you to answer this one in your head. It's 9.59 a.m. Bergen hunting Brenda logs in. She puts in a tiny order to buy just one single contract at $50. 1 minute later, at 10.00 a.m., frantic Frank barrels in. He's an institutional trader, and he slams in an order to buy 1,000 contracts at $50. So Frank has massive volume, Brenda has the bare minimum. They are tied on price. When a seller offers a contract at $50, whose order does the CLOB fill first?
I'll give everyone a second.
Think about it. Frank's 1,000 or Brenda's 1?
The answer is Brenda. And this trips up candidates who let real-world business logic cloud their exam knowledge.
Brenda. The tiny retail trader beats the whale. Why doesn't the exchange cater to the massive volume?
Because in the electronic CLOB, size absolutely does not matter. This is a huge exam trap. The test writers will emphasize the sheer volume of an order to trick you into assuming a massive block can bully its way to the front of the queue. It cannot.
So the matching engine is totally blind to Frank's financial weight.
Completely blind. It only sees price and time. Brenda was earlier, so she gets filled first. Best price, then earliest time. Never size.
Fascinating and totally counterintuitive, which makes it a perfect trap. Now, that's how the CLOB matches orders. But where do these electronic orders actually live before they get matched? Because I'm just tapping an app on my phone. Where is my physical data resting?
That brings us to a highly technical distinction. Native versus synthetic orders. This usually applies to stop orders, which we'll cover next, but it's vital for understanding systemic market risk.
Okay, break down the geography for me. What is native versus synthetic?
Think about the physical location of the server. Imagine the exchange's matching engine in Aurora, Illinois, as the kitchen. A native order is like setting the timer directly on the oven. The instruction lives on the CME's own internal servers. When the trigger price hits, the exchange executes it instantly. Latency is essentially zero.
Okay, so the ultimate boss is holding the instructions natively. What about synthetic?
A synthetic order is like setting a timer on your smartphone while you're sitting upstairs in your bedroom. The instruction does not live at the exchange. It lives on your retail broker's server or even locally on your laptop. The broker's computer watches the market data feed. When it sees your trigger price hit, the broker's software generates a brand new market order and fires it across the country to the exchange.
Wait, that implies a massive chain of potential failures.
A terrifying amount of risk, yes. If your broker server crashes or your Wi-Fi drops at the exact millisecond the market hits your trigger, your order doesn't fire. The exchange doesn't even know it exists.
So for the Series 3, do the actual trading rules change based on whether it's native or synthetic?
No, and that's the trick. The placement, the margin rules, the mechanics, they're identical for both. The exam just wants to make sure you don't blindly assume every electronic order resides safely at the exchange. Do not assume every electronic stop is held by the exchange.
The oven timer versus the smartphone timer. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you mentioned stop orders, and it is time we tackle what I consider the most dangerous tripwires in the market. Let's move into stop orders.
Candidates really need to focus here. A stop order or stop loss is fundamentally different from a market or limit order in its initial state. It is dormant, it's asleep, it doesn't even exist on the CLO, it just hides in the digital weeds until the market trades at or through its specific trigger price.
I always think of a stop like a defensive tripwire you set across the doorway of a room you're currently running away from. You're terrified of something chasing you, so you set a trap behind you. But here is the critical part, bringing us right back to our golden rule. What does it become? Once the price hits the tripwire, the dormant stop order violently wakes up and instantly mutates into a pure market order.
Precisely. It inherits Frantic Frank's genetic code. It guarantees a fill, not a price. Slippage absolutely applies.
Let's visualize this with Frantic Frank. Frank is our panic-stricken trader, and stop orders are pure panic buttons. Say Frank is long a futures contract. He owns it. He needs the price to go up. But he's terrified the market will crash. Where does he physically place his tripwire?
Well, look at where the danger is coming from. If he's long, he benefits from rising prices. The existential threat is a falling price. The danger is beneath him. So he must place a sell stop below the current market price.
Sell stop below. Let's say the market is at $50. His long from 50. He can only stomach a 5-point loss. So he places his sell stop tripwire down at 45. The market starts tanking. 49, 48, 47. Boom, a trade hits exactly 45. What happens in the server room?
The instant a trade occurs at 45, Frank's dormant sell stop wakes up, converts into a market order, and screams into the CLO, "Get me out right now at the best bid." It violently yanks him out of his long position, stopping the bleeding.
But because it turned into a market order, he might not actually get out at 45, right?
That's slippage. In a free fall, the buyers at 45 might be gone. He might have to reach down to 44 or 42 to find a buyer. The stop order guaranteed he escaped the burning building. It didn't guarantee the temperature of the room when he exited.
Now, that's defensive. But a sell stop below the market can be offensive too, right?
Absolutely. Say you don't have a position, but you see a massive support floor at 45. You believe if it breaks, the market will plummet to 30. You can place a sell stop at 44.99. If the floor breaks, your tripwire snaps, turning into a market order that enters you into a brand new short position to ride the crash downward.
Okay, let's flip Frank's strategy. Frank is now short the market. He needs the price to drop. What's his existential threat?
A massive face-ripping rally. Because if you're short, your potential losses are mathematically infinite. If the price goes to the moon, the danger is above him.
So, listener, if you want to protect a short position, what do you do? Think about where the danger is.
I'll give him a second.
You place a buy stop above the market. The market is 50. Frank is short. He places his buy stop up at 55. The market rallies to 55. The tripwire snaps. It becomes a market order. And it buys a contract to cover his short, capping his infinite risk. Or, offensively, he uses it to catch an upside breakout.
And this brings us to a massive pattern interrupt. Let's unpack this, because this is exactly where people fail. Candidates constantly flip these placements in their heads during the exam because they associate buy with low prices and sell with high prices.
Memorize this dynamic. A stop chases the price the exact same way you would run. If the price is running UP away from you, you buy a stop UP to catch it. If it's crashing down, you sell a stop down, buy stop UP. Sell stop down end. It is a reactive chasing mechanism.
Flipping these is the number one exam error. And further, they will try to confuse a sell stop with a sell limit.
The word sell acts like camouflage. but a sell stop is a panic button placed below the market. A sell limit is a target placed above the market, waiting patiently.
Sell stop equals rests below. Sell limit equals rests above. Do not conflate the two.
Perfectly clear.
Hmm.
But what if I'm a trader who understands slippage, but I completely refuse to accept it? Enter, Stubborn Steve. Let's look at the control freaks and stop limit orders.
Stubborn Steve is the avatar for the stop limit order. It's a hybrid. Initially, it rests dormant off the books, exactly like a plain stop. But apply the golden rule. What does it become? When triggered, it absolutely does not turn into a market order. It mutates into a limit order,
which changes the entire DNA of the trade.
It flips the grand trade-off. Because it becomes a limit order, it guarantees a price, or better, but it accepts the massive risk of no fill at all.
Let's put Steve in the hot seat. Steve is long from 50. He places a sell stop limit below the market at 40. He wants to stop his loss, but he refuses to take a penny less than 40.
Wait, Stubborn Steve just put a limit on a panic button. What if the market craters overnight over the weekend and opens at 30?
That is gap risk, highly testable. The market gaps straight past Steve's $40 trigger. The system sees it traded below 40, so the order wakes up, but it becomes a limit order at 40. It looks at the current price of 30 and says, Steve told me not to sell for less than 40. So it just sits on the book at 40, completely unexecuted. So the market is at 30, bleeding down to 20, and Steve's protection is uselessly sitting up at 40. He traded the certainty of getting out just to control the price.
Yep. He is left holding a massive losing position. The building collapsed on him.
Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison. Plain stop becomes market. Guarantees fill. Risk is slippage.
Yeah.
Stop limit becomes limit. Guarantees price. Risk is gap risk or no fill. Exam trap call out right here. If a question stresses a protection from a bad price but might not get filled, you are looking at a stop limit.
Exactly. And the placement is identical to a plain stop. Buy above, sell below. Do not let the word limit trick you into flipping the placement in your head.
Okay, we've watched Frank panic, Steve paralyze himself. It is time for my favorite character. Let's examine the opportunists. Market if touched or MIT orders. Bring in bargain hunting Brenda.
An MIT order rests exactly like a stop order until it touches the trigger. And then what does it become? It becomes a market order. Guarantees a fill, not a price.
Wait, if it sleeps off the books, wakes up, and turns into a market order exactly like a plain stop, what's the twist?
The big twist is that an MIT is the exact mirror image of a stop. It sits on the opposite side of the market for the opposite reason.
Brenda demonstrates this perfectly. She wants to buy, but wants a deal. She waits for a dip. So she places a buy MIT below the current price. Or, if she's long and wants to cash out profits into a rally, she places a sell MIT above the market.
And here is the signature trap of the whole unit.
Hey, Series 3 test writer, we see what you're doing here. Listen up, listener, because this is huge. Both a buy MIT and a sell stop sit below the market.
Same exact location. The difference is intent. Brenda's buy MIT is a shopping order, hoping for a favorable dip. Frank's sell stop is a panic button reacting to a move against him.
Same location, opposite name, opposite intent. The exam will give you the right price location, but the wrong order name. Memory aid. Stops chase the price. Buy stop EP, sell stop down in. And MIT is a mirror, so it flips. Buy MIT down to buy the dip, sell MIT EP to sell the rally.
Phenomenal framework. Stops chase, MIT's wait. But remember, an MIT still becomes a market order, so slippage still applies when Brenda gets her fill.
Slippage comes for us all. All right, this has been an incredibly dense mechanical journey. We need to tie the entire 60-minute deep dive together. Let's hit the direction matrix.
The source material calls this the most important artifact in the unit. Let's do a rapid-fire drill. I'll prompt, you answer.
I love a rapid-fire drill. Listener, mentally answer these as we go. Ready?
I stop.
Placed above E becomes market. Guarantees fill.
Sell stop.
Placed below becomes market. Guarantees fill.
Buy stop limit.
Placed above E becomes limit. Guarantees price.
Sell MIT.
Placed above E becomes market. Guarantees fill.
Buy MIT.
Placed below becomes market. Guarantees fill.
Beautiful. Final repetition. Any order that becomes a market order guarantees a fill, not a price. Any order that becomes a limit order guarantees a price, but risks no fill at all.
Perfect. We absolutely crushed the basic order types.
We did. But before we wrap, I want to leave you with a final mind-expanding thought. We talked about electronic markets and price-time priority. Down to the millisecond, right?
Yeah. Earliest time wins the tiebreaker.
But if algorithmic high-frequency trading bots are placing and canceling millions of orders in microseconds during a flash crash, what does time priority really mean for a human trader simply trying to get a market order filled? Does a guaranteed fill even matter if a computer algorithm dictates 20 points of slippage before you can even blink?
Oh, wow. That is terrifying. It totally questions if time priority is actually fair to retail traders. That is definitely something to mull over while you're grinding through practice exams. Apply this matrix, watch out for the exact traps we flagged, and you're going to dominate this section. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Good luck studying, and we'll see you next time.